BBC News, I'm John Shea. Hamas has indicated that it's accepted a proposal for a ceasefire in Gaza negotiated by Egypt and Qatar. The Palestinian Islamist group issued its statement hours after Israel instructed around 100,000 civilians to evacuate part of the southern city of Rafah ahead of a ground incursion. Hamas gave no further details, but the proposal is understood to involve a temporary truce and the release of some Israeli hostages. It's not clear if Israel has accepted the terms. Israel's evacuation order has caused an international outcry. Aid agencies have warned that a ground assault would cause a catastrophe in Rafah, which is packed with more than a million people. Scott Anderson, Gaza director for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, said thousands had already fled.
Over 6,000 people so far have left Rafah, headed toward Khan Yunis or the middle area. And that includes not just people in the evacuation zone, but also people across Rafah. I think people are quite nervous that they won't find somewhere good to set up their tent, or that if they wait, they won't be able to take their tent with them. And they just want to find somewhere that they can set up and try to find the basic necessities for their families every day.
Russia says President Putin has ordered tactical nuclear weapons drills near Ukraine in response to what it called Western threats to deploy troops there. Danny Eberhard reports.
Russia's Ministry of Defense said the planned drills would increase the readiness of its non-strategic nuclear forces. Short-range tactical nuclear weapons are less powerful than strategic ones, but nevertheless would devastate smaller areas. Moscow's been angered in part by comments from President Macron. He's refused to rule out potentially deploying French troops, were Kyiv to request that. The Kremlin's also denounced a recent remark by the British Foreign Secretary that appeared to suggest Kyiv could use British-made weapons on targets inside Russia.
The judge at Donald Trump's criminal trial has threatened the former US president with jail for contempt of court. He said it was the 10th instance of contempt that he'd committed in the case. Mr. Trump has pleaded not guilty to criminal charges of falsifying business records to cover up payments to a porn actress. Our correspondent, Nada Taufik, is in New York.
In his strongest warning yet, Judge Juan Marchand said jail time would be a last resort and one he was trying to avoid at all costs. He acknowledged the implications of jailing a presidential candidate and the security challenges that come with incarcerating a former president with a Secret Service detail. In his written ruling, he said Trump's unsubstantiated comments in an interview that the jury was 95% Democrat after a rushed process called into question the legitimacy of proceedings and raised the specter of fear for the safety of jurors.
Nada Taufik reporting. This is the latest world news from the BBC. Scientists collaborating in Britain and the United States say they've developed a vaccine that could prevent a range of different coronavirus outbreaks before they start. The novel shot, so far just tested in mice, appears to offer broad protection because it primes the immune system to target proteins shared across different types of coronavirus. Regulators would first need to approve the technology. A multi-storey residential building that was under construction in the South African coastal city of George has collapsed, raising fears that dozens may be trapped under the rubble. A local official said at least 20 people have been rescued, some with serious injuries. The election authorities in India say political parties mustn't use artificial intelligence to create deepfake videos and spread misinformation. They added that any such content must be removed within 3 hours of the party being notified. The warning came on the eve of the third of seven voting rounds in parliamentary elections. The past weeks have seen a spate of deepfake videos circulating on social media. Last week, the social media chief of the main opposition Congress Party was detained over a doctored video. The British government says it will require new public spaces to provide single-sex toilets. Harry Farley reports.
This long-promised legislation is part of a series of government announcements around sex and gender. The Equalities Minister, Kemi Badenoch, argues gender-neutral toilets deny privacy and dignity to both men and women. The new building regulations will force all new non-domestic buildings and those undergoing major refurbishments to have separate male and female or self-contained toilets. The government says most of the responses to an official consultation supported the intention for separate male and female toilets, and the change would ease safety concerns as well as reducing longer waiting times in shared queues.
And that's the latest BBC World News.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground.
Welcome to A Public Affair. I'm your Monday host, Douglas Haynes. Last week, the Madison Common Council hosted the first in a series of community budget conversations about the city's 2025 operating budget. This budget faces a $27 million structural deficit, and state law mandates that the city balance its budget each year. As a result, the city of Madison is facing hard choices about major spending cuts and options for increasing revenues, such as a possible first-ever referendum to raise property taxes, or a combination of both cuts and property tax referendum to eliminate the budget deficit. To further community conversations about the City of Madison 2025 budget, I'm joined by 3 guests in the studio today. We hope to also include you in the conversation, your comments and questions about the city budget, and we're going to learn more about the city budget process today as well. First, I'll introduce my guests. We have with us Yannette Figueroa Cole, who's the Alder representing District 10 and is the Madison Common Council President. Welcome to Public Affair, Yannette.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have with us David Schmidtke, Finance Director for the City of Madison. Thanks for being here, David.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, we also have Sam Munger, Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway's Chief of Staff. Welcome to Public Affair, Sam.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And welcome, listeners. We'd love for you to join our conversation today. If you have a question about the City of Madison budget or budget process, or you want to share a perspective on the city's finances and budget priorities, please give us a call. It's 608-256-2001, extension 9. Again, that's 608-256-2001, extension 9. We're envisioning this as a radio extension of those ongoing budget community conversations that are happening over this month and next month. So we'll start with the basic lay of the land in terms of the City of Madison budget for 2025. And David, I've been told you are the expert on this topic as finance director for the City of Madison. So we're going to start with you for the details about the budget deficit in particular and what the causes of this deficit are as well.
Great. Thanks for that question, Douglas. Just to give you a little bit of background on the city budget for the current year we're in, 2024, it's a little over $400 million. And that's in what we call our general fund, which supports the activities that residents really see every day, the refuse and recycling pickup, the snow plowing, our law enforcement and emergency medical services, our libraries, our parks, and so on. And when we look ahead to next year and compare how much our revenues are allowed to grow under state law with our cost to continue those current services at current levels, the gap right now is estimated at about $27 million. There's a number of reasons for how we've gotten here. A lot of it is the structure of how Wisconsin and state law finances or allows cities to finance their services. combine that with the economic impacts of the COVID pandemic and how the way that the city's revenues to finance its services are really not connected so much to the economy, like say a sales tax or an income tax is, which both the state and the county, for example, county has a sales tax, the city does not, and both the city and the county saw large increases in revenues, you know, as people started buying things after the pandemic. We don't have that. And so that's a part of it. A part of it is, and we were able to keep services going through the pandemic because of the American Rescue Plan Act, the federal legislation that delivered really historic levels of support to local governments and states throughout our country. And Madison received about $47 million from that. About half of that was put into sort of one-time supports for community services, so homelessness, youth employment, violence prevention, programs like that. And then the other half was kept to help maintain current service levels, which was another part of the federal legislation. And when we look at what our revenues would have been prior to the pandemic, you know, if we, that growth trend, compared to what actually happened, we're still about 5 to 10% below. If you look at the state and the county, they're well above. And so that gives you a sense of how state law kind of affects our ability to have the revenues to support the services of really the fastest growing city in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Before we get into options for addressing what you just described, David, I think it's worth going into a little bit more detail about two of the issues you just mentioned there. I'm going to start with one that's more general, which is on the surface, at least by some measures, one would see Madison as the most prosperous city in the state of Wisconsin, right? Mm-hmm. So one might ask, how could this happen in the most prosperous city that we would have this kind of major budget shortfall? And you were talking just now about differences in revenues that the state and the county enjoy and what mm-hmm. the city enjoys. So tell us a little bit more about why that prosperity doesn't translate to city government exactly.
Right. Thanks for that question. That's a great question. It's really at the core of what's going on here. So the cities in Wisconsin, Madison's not any different than any other city for the most part other than Milwaukee, are heavily reliant on the property tax. We have the highest reliance on property tax in the Midwest and probably the highest, among the highest in the country. And that's a design of state law that the local services are funded by the property tax. And then how Wisconsin does it is they have a system of where they're supposed to share revenues. Income and sales taxes collected at the state level shared with local governments. That has not been the case for over 20 years until the most recent state budget where there was a significant increase. What Madison has seen is reductions in shared revenue disproportionately sort of allocated to Madison. And then in this most recent large increase in shared revenue, Madison got the lowest amount per capita. And that was a design of the legislature. They set it up that way. And that's the situation we're in. So when you look at the amount of state aid per capita, Madison gets $29 per person, per resident. The average statewide is $142. So you can see the disparity there. The other, like I said, we just don't have the breadth of revenues that other cities around the country have. We don't have a local sales tax. We don't have a local income tax that other places often have, or even say regional transit authorities have in other states. We don't have that here. So we have to use the property tax to help support a transit system, for example. So that's a big element of why we're here. The other is the state really controls growth in property taxes. So while we're getting a lot of people moving to Madison, we're getting appreciation in property values and things like that, our taxes can only go up by this formula that's tied to the value of new construction in the city. And that growth rate over the last few years in particular has been well below inflation, and then well below inflation and population growth.
So the city is sort of squeezed in multiple ways, it sounds like.
Absolutely, yeah. Yep.
So you just mentioned there that we have a few options, potentially local sales tax, transit fees, the property tax increase potentially. Tell us a little bit more about those, and then maybe later in the show we'll get back to that shared revenue piece and talk about the politics of that more. But for now, let's stick with the local budget options.
Well, you mentioned sales and income tax. We don't have that option.
Yeah.
So
it's not on the table.
No, nope. Okay. The only way that Madison could do that is if the state legislature passed a law allowing Madison to do it. So we're not allowed to do it under current state law. And then the property tax, as I said, is limited under this formula, with the only option to increase it above that amount is a voter referendum. So that's our option on the property tax side. We do have other revenue sources, but they're very limited. So when you look at all of the revenue streams to the city budget, nearly 3/4 comes from the property tax. A little over 10% comes from the state in the form of state aid, and the remaining roughly 20% is what we call like fees, special charges, like when you get a building permit or if you need to have an ambulance take you to the hospital. We have fees for those sorts of things, but it's only about 20% of the budget, and the fees can't exceed the cost of actually providing the service. So it's not like a tax in the sense that it can cover other activities. So that's the revenue side. We also have the ability to do what are called special charges. We've done a couple of those over the last decade, one for urban forestry, and you'll see this on your water bill. There's a listing like stormwater and things like that. Urban forestry is one example. Another is the resource recovery special charge related to recycling pickup. But even the state limits some of those as well in terms of how much you can do with that. The other side of it is looking at expenditures. And when we look at expenditures, that's really about the level of services that residents can expect to receive in that whole list that I started off with in terms of trash collection, our parks, libraries, and so on.
So there's potential for those services to be cut potentially to save money.
As you said at the outset, we have to balance the budget. Yeah. So, yeah.
You're listening to A Public Affair on WRT 89.9 FM Madison. I'm Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking today about the City of Madison's 2025 budget with Madison Common Council President Yannette Figueroa Cole, City of Madison Finance Director Dave Schmidtke, and Sam Munger, Chief of Staff for Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway. If you have a question about the City of Madison budget or a comment about city budget priorities, please do give us a call. Join the conversation at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd love to have your questions and perspectives in this conversation. I think we'll go to whoever would like to field the question now about the process, the budget process. What's the timeline for decision making?
I'll take that.
Okay,
one.
David?
So the budget process really takes an entire year, but we kick off the operating budget process in June, so next month, in terms of the mayor giving instructions to the agencies in terms of developing their budget. Prior to that, we're working on estimates of the costs to continue current services for the upcoming year. And that's a technical process that's underway right now. This year, I think we really have started the information process much earlier, just given the breadth and scope of the gap that we're talking about. So, we put together information series. We briefed the council. The council adopted a guidance resolution on what how agencies should build their budgets, given the what we're seeing in terms of the gap. The agencies spend about 6 weeks putting their budgets together, and then the mayor takes that information and puts together a balanced budget. That's and over the course of the summer, the rest of the summer. And then that operating budget is introduced to the council in early October. And then the council then, the finance committee meets in October to amend that budget, and the council meets to act on both the entire budget in second week in November. So they have to adopt a balanced budget at that point, and at the same time set the property tax levy. Now the council has engaged in a series of, scheduled a series of budget conversations to sort of help to get input from the community. That'll happen in May and June. And then if there is a referendum, under state law, there needs to be a resolution adopted by the council that sets the ballot question. And the state's pretty prescriptive in how that reads. And that needs to be adopted no later than 70 days before effectively the November election. Mm-hmm. So the council has a meeting on August 6th. So that would be the no later than that meeting would a ballot resolution need to be adopted.
So this is going to be hashed out over the next 6 months, essentially.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Well, you just mentioned Madison Common Council and that you've transitioned to some, you know, community dialogue happening with them, through them. We're going to transition now here to Yannette Figueroa Cole, president of the Madison Common Council, to tell us, first of all, where the council is in your position on this process and the values that the council wants to uphold in this budget. And then we'll get into more about your public interactions.
It's like Director Shmiriki was saying, the budget is a full year process. So it is something that we manage in almost every meeting, because we're always making changes to resolutions. So it's a continue process. So this year, the only difference from prior years is that we are actually have a full staff council's office that supports activities such as the one that we're doing today, of actually going out and engaging people at a regional and larger scale. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be able to do that without having the resources that we currently have. So as mentioned earlier, we put a resolution forward asking for what would a referendum look like, but also what things would like without a referendum. So that's kind of the basis of the ask. So we are, you know, being specific, but also broader questions like, okay, what will fees look like versus special charges? What are the options there? And the most pressing question or most important question for us elders is to really understand that this is not a 2025 issue. This is an ongoing issue that will continue for more years to come.
The structural difference
will continue. So that's the part that we really want to be able to better communicate to our constituents. So these informational sessions is really to collect their feedback, but also provide them the tools and the understanding of where we are today, and so they can make informed decisions. We know that, of course, we're getting emails about cutting a specific dollar amount or cutting services, but we really like to understand what is exactly that people value the most? Which services are they really willing to let go of? So it's not as simple as saying, "Oh, we're just gonna cut $27 million." I mean, the streets department budget is $27 million. Uh-huh. So let's put that into perspective and say, okay, what exactly is it that has the less value for you of all the services that the city provides? So that's really, to me, for many of us in the council, is that understanding or that acknowledgement that this is an ongoing situation, and it has been a situation that started years ago. So we've been on this trench for a long time, from prior administrations to this administration, and for people to really understand this didn't came up out of nowhere. Without the pandemic, we will be here regardless, maybe a couple years down the road, but the pandemic really just accelerated the process.
So you had this first public listening session last week, or community engagement session.
around the budget. What did you hear there last week, Alder Figueroa-Cole, and what were the kind of priorities that people voiced?
So I was pretty pleased, first of all, with so many people that show up. We had like 13 tables plus in there, and average like 10 people per table. So we had a lot of engagement. The room was packed. And on a summary level, it was very pleasing to hear people really discuss the equity of the services. Of course, there were people there thinking about how this impacts my day-to-day personal situation, and I understand that and I sympathize with that. But there were also a lot of people thinking how this impacts people that are perhaps not in a good place as I am today. So the equity question was there. I was pleased to see the clergy be part of this process, because they also work with people that are, you know, less privileged or that need more support. So there were people there that had questions about Metro. So I think we still need to do a better job explaining how the Metro enterprise works and how the city supports that service. And also combining, you know, like, I feel like we need to present a better picture of what Metro does versus the BRT, and how increasing the use will increase the revenue and to become self-sustainable. So
just to jump in, bus rapid transit is what you're referring to,
correct,
right? The new bus BRT. Rapid transit
yep.
System that's being installed across to help people move quickly across the city.
Right, correct. And for most of those, I mean, the complexity there is that we're talking about capital, the capital budget versus the operating budget. We're talking about federal funding versus the tax funding. So I feel like we still need to do a little bit more work bringing that picture to provide more clarity. So those two things, people really talking about equity and Metro, were kind of the two things that came up for me from that meeting.
Thank you. It was really helpful to hear in particular kind of the people that were there who was there to be invested in this conversation already, and what the themes were that were rising up. We're going to turn to you, Sam Munker, Chief of Staff for Mayor Satya Rhodes-Conway. Let's jump in specifically, first of all, with what Yannette was just talking about public perceptions around bus rapid transit and the Madison Metro system in general, because that's been obviously a huge topic of a conversation in the city, and it's a big initiative of the mayor, the bus rapid transit system. So let's sort of try to separate out what parts of that conversation have to do with the 2025 budget and what parts don't. As Alder Yannette Figueroa-Cole mentioned, you know, some of that is funded by other sources than the city budget.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. And obviously, as you said, it's been quite a topic of conversation both before people were aware of the budget crisis and in the context of the budget crisis. And I think we could talk about the need for greater for transit solutions and for transportation. I mean, for growing cities, which Madison is, and that's a good position to be in, the things that really form the core are housing for people and a way for those people to get from their housing to jobs and services. We obviously have work to do on housing, but the city is working on it, and I think folks recognize the necessity of that. The other thing people need, as I said, is a way to get around the city as the city grows. And that is exactly what both bus rapid transit and the Metro redesign and other pieces of that, and traffic safety measures, you know, bicycle safety, car safety, are all designed to address that. And I think that's one important thing for folks to understand. That is a lifeblood of a city. So it's important to spend money on that. Now, getting through to the sort of crux of what you said, I think it's what is difficult to explain to folks is the distinction between a capital budget and an operating budget. I will give you an educated layman's version. And if you want a more technical definition, Dave, our finance director, can certainly do that. But in short, your capital budget is money that you borrow by putting municipal bonds and other instruments on the market, and you use that to build physical infrastructure typically. Operating budget is what comes from the things that we talked about before, property tax, fees and revenues, and so on. And that typically funds the sort of, you might say, day-to-day operations of the city. And in the case of Madison and most cities, that basically means the staff that provide the services that you see out on the streets every day: police, fire, garbage pickup, libraries, park staff, the sort of classic things that people interact with. One of the things that I took away from the meeting, I also attended the public session, was just the positivity and the sort of appreciation of folks for city services and for Madison as a place. There just was a lot of love for Madison in that room, which is not to say people didn't have concerns around, say, affordability or around specific aspects, but just people really appreciate those services and really appreciate the parks and really appreciate the libraries. And just it came back to that. That's what the operating budget pays for. In terms of both bus rapid transit and, for that matter, other capital expenditures, so say rebuilding the John Nolan Causeway, which, you know, the bridges are in need of repair. Let's say the public market or the Imagination Center out at Rheindahl Park, these amazing facilities, those are all coming from the capital budget. We could, that has an impact on property taxes, but it does not, getting rid of those would not help close the $27 million gap in the operating budget. It does not have a direct impact on those. So that, I think, is sort of the key thing for folks to understand. It's not as simple as saying, oh, let's just take the money that we're, you know, and by the, as President Figueroa Cole said, a lot of that is federal dollars that is specifically for building rapid transit that is clean and energy efficient and so on. We can't, you can't take those federal dollars and you can't take the lending that we've done and just zip it in to plug a hole someplace else, right? It's specifically for those things. So it doesn't, that does not have any real direct impact on the budget gap that we're talking about and on the solutions for it. And that, but, you know, that being said, we obviously, as the Alder said, we have to do a better job of explaining that to folks. That distinction can be a little complicated, but we have to make that clear. We have to explain that this is largely federal funding. It's a one-time funding. This was our big chance to get, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in investment in our community. We have to explain the importance of it to folks and importance to the city. So, you know, that I don't mean to put it on the populace and say, ah, how come you guys don't understand this complicated distinction? That's something that we and the city and the Common Council and as staff have to do a better job of communicating about and explaining to folks, which is part of what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, and you just made that distinction really clear for us. So thank you for that. That was Sam Munger, Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway's Chief of Staff here on A Public Affair on WRT 89.9 FM Madison. We are talking about the 2025 Madison City budget process, which is ongoing right now, and the $27 million structural deficit the city is facing and potential options for closing that deficit. We would love to hear your questions, your perspectives here on A Public Affair today. Give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We are here with the experts on the topic wanting to create community conversation around this, and they want to hear from you. So please do give us a call, 608-256-2001, extension 9. So we're going to return to you now, Sam, to talk just a little bit more broadly now about the mayor's budget priorities for this upcoming budget cycle.
Yeah, great question. So at a high level, the mayor has a set of key policy priorities, and I don't think these will come as a surprise to anyone in the community. They've been pretty consistent from the beginning of her first term, more or less, interrupted, of course, by a minor pandemic or a major pandemic. They include the need for more housing, especially affordable housing. They include the need for transportation, and the need for safety around transportation, right? That's the Vision Zero plan that folks may have heard about, which is about reducing the number of fatalities from traffic to zero. They include sustainability and thinking about and resilience, thinking about the way we interact with the environment, how we impact it, how it impacts us. And they include economic opportunity and equity for all folks in the community. Those things are up on our website. People can read more about them. And of course, I'm also happy to talk more about them if folks have questions. But I think it's fair to say that for this year, the mayor's number one priority and our number one priority as an office is around the finding a long-term sustainable solution for this budget situation, right? That is the top thing that is on our mind right now. And we want to come up with a solution that maintains city services and maintains the things that people value so much, like libraries, parks, you know, police, fire, our new CARES program. We could, you know, run through a litany of things that came up at this meeting that folks appreciate. It's also a solution that keeps our community affordable for a wide range of residents, for a really broad and diverse community. And that's obviously a concern that came up at that meeting as well, about affordability, specifically often around the cost of housing and property, but on a whole range of things. This is a growing and thriving city, which also has meant that the cost of living has gone up. And we also want it to be not a sort of one-term fix. And as both Dave and the Alder alluded to, this is a problem that's been many years, decades really in the making. And the city has done an admirable job over the years of finding these ways to save a little money here, you know, to cut this salary, to have a person do two jobs rather than one, to be more efficient, to find one-time pots of money. But at long last, you know, essentially the bill has come due, and we need to figure out a solution that's not, doesn't just bridge us through to the next year and then we're back in the same situation, or we're back asking people for money again. We want to come up with a solution that puts us in a solid, stable financial footing for a number of years going forward, until we can hopefully, you know, maybe find some other revenue mechanisms. And also, as I said, doesn't bring us where we're back in the situation coming to the public again in a year saying, we're in the same boat, we have to make more cuts, we have to raise taxes more. So that is the thing really that we are spending a lot of our time and energy focused on right now, and will be, as we said, basically through the end of this year.
And obviously, Sam, you're gathering public feedback at this stage, but is the mayor already sort of advocating for a set of solutions, or have a set of solutions that you all are studying in mind?
I mean, I think Dave outlined the set of solutions, and in many ways, it's a set of solutions that incredibly constrained by state law. We just don't have that many options. And I can say I talked to colleagues in cities in other states, and the range of things that they can do, the range of special fees and incorporation charges and so on that they can use to fill their budgets that we are not allowed to do. We are precluded by the state legislature in a very intentional way. Blows my mind. We only have a few very narrow options. They are raising property taxes, some set of fees that Dave could talk about, but that includes, say, the urban forestry or resource collection, and those are limited. Resource recovery, sorry, those are limited. There's just not that many of them, and they can't only be raised a certain amount. Or cutting city services. And so those are the solutions that we are looking at. Those are the ones that we are seeking feedback on. And those are really the only things that are on the table, for better or worse.
Are there particular city services that you're either hearing about as potential for cutting, or that you all have in mind? Obviously, nobody goes into this process wanting to cut in certain areas, but are there some that jump out more than others that are potential options for saving money?
I mean, I can take a first cut if you want, and I'm curious to know what the Alder hears as well. But, you know, I guess I would say one thing to start with is to know that City of Madison has a fairly high level of services. We do things that other cities often don't, like collecting large items for free. However, we do that because citizens have asked for it. And over the years, we have already, you know, we have cut in a lot of ways that are, we hope, not super obvious, because we want people to, you know, to feel like they're still getting the level of service. But we have really, a lot of the cuts that are easy to make have already been made. So the other thing I'd say is, as we've been engaging with the public, there are not services that folks are coming to us and saying, please cut, right? Pretty much across the board, people are saying, I love this, I love that. Do you like libraries? Oh, absolutely. We want more libraries. We want more services at libraries. Do you like parks? Absolutely. We want more parks. Do you want less garbage? No. We couldn't possibly do with less garbage collection or brush collection. There are zero things that people are coming to us and asking about that would actually impact the operating budget, right? So I think all of that leads us to lean more heavily in the direction of revenue sources to try to maintain those services. I think that the other thing we will try to look for though we have done a lot of it already, is efficiencies, right? Are there ways we can do more with less? Are there ways we can provide the same or almost the same level of services, but with less impact on the general fund? And that includes things that Dave could get into in more detail, like holding positions open for a little bit longer, which saves the city money. Other kinds of, little things under the surface. As I said, people filling two jobs. So they plow snow in the winter and then they work in the parks in the summer rather than having two different seasonal folks, right? You have one person and then they have a year-round job, and that saves us as well, mm-hmm. saves us on training and hiring and so on. So I know that's a little bit of a non-answer, but I think, in some ways I'm non-answering in reflection of what we're hearing from the public, sure. which is there is no city service that people are clamoring mm-hmm. to have less of. Mm-hmm. It is more across the board.
Mm-hmm. But, I just want to bring in a comment from a listener real quick. Ian is not on the line, but he called in to say or ask, how is it that a city as affluent as Madison is running into scarcity when it comes to our public goods? And we were talking about this a little bit earlier. Now, I want to remind listeners, please do give us a call at 608-256-2001 extension 9 if you, like Ian, have a question about the city budget process. But maybe this is an opportunity to really talk about those limitations that the state puts on the city, more specifically, shared revenue and others, and what the political possibilities are for addressing those limitations. Who wants to take that one?
Sam? I mean, I feel like okay. I've been talking a lot, yeah. but I have strong opinions okay. on this, having worked at the state level and having worked quite a bit with other states as well that have different political setups. The scarcity in public goods in Madison is artificially created. It is created by constraints imposed by the legislature that limit the ways that we can raise revenue and to provide those public goods. That's full stop. And it's very intentional, and it's more or less, a lot of it has occurred in the last 10 to 15 years, mm-hmm. since 2010. And that money has been siphoned off to the state for all sorts of other priorities, but often for significant tax cuts to the wealthy and corporations, like the manufacturing and agricultural tax cut, which goes to about 30 people and is hundreds of millions of dollars. That is what the current legislative majority in its wisdom has elected to do, which is to pull money out of cities and give it to rich individuals. So the scarcity here is a direct consequence of those resources being shifted to rich people across the state and to by and large, smaller communities in other parts of the state. Money resources have been extracted from Milwaukee and Madison and distributed throughout to smaller regions. Now, I think there's political reasons for that people could obviously speculate on. It's also the case that Madison is, doing better than a lot of parts of northern Wisconsin. So there are equity considerations mm-hmm. there as well. I'm trying to remember the second half of Ian's question, which was about the sort of political, that's right, the prospects. So I think, this is, speculating outside of the official bounds of a nonpartisan political office, but, we know that the legislative maps are going to be different in November. We know that the resulting legislature, one way or another, is going to have a different composition. And I think that always gives hope for change, especially in a state like Madison that has been, state like Wisconsin and a city like Madison, where the state legislature has been gerrymandered within an inch of its life for the last 10 years. So there's been almost very little political accountability, and it's been incredibly static. So the prospect for change is good, is optimism inducing, and it's real, but it is not going to be immediate. For one thing, none of that change will come in time for next year's budget. Mm-hmm. So this conversation is happening irrespective of any change in the state law. Just to go back a half step to restate what folks have kind of said, it would require a change in state law to alleviate that scarcity, right? It would require the legislature changing the shared revenue formula or allowing a local option sales tax or a local option income tax or any of the other things, or reallocating money from the wealthy and corporations down to the city. That political change is likely to take a while. It's not only is it not going to happen for this budget period, it's not likely to happen immediately, right? The composition of the legislature, and it's a big shift, means that it's going to be years, probably. It's not to say it can't. I think that needs to be part of the long-term considerations for the city, for the mayor, for the council, for the public, when they think about what the solution is 5, 10, 15 years out. It's not a 1 or 2 or 3 year solution. It is a 5-year solution. It is a 10-year solution. It is going to take a long time and a lot of work on the part of local folks and state folks to advocate for that and to create that change at the state level. So that would be my not so short answer to that question.
Go ahead, Yannette Cole.
Sure, thank you. So, I mean, I'd like to add to what Sammy's saying there a couple of things. One, like I was commenting to you earlier before we started the show, I'm a little bit of a nerd when it comes to the city budget. Like, I like to look at the numbers and focus on that. So anyone, I understand the budget is complicated and it's not just like your household budget. It takes a little bit more than that. But we have every single budget for the last 10 years posted online. Anyone can go and see, compare the numbers. Oh, I mean, I've done that. I can compare the share revenue, how we went from this level to just being flat for 10 years. We like over $18 million that we didn't receive over the past few years. So so it's like everything it literally is an open book for anyone to go and see for themselves. But in addition to that, and what Sam was saying, I would like for maybe Dave, because I don't want to misspeak on this, I'm not the expert on that regard, but one of the things that I have learned in the process is also who can be taxed based on the legislation. Like not everyone on the city, there's a lot of exceptions that the legislation put on us and also prevent us from creating more revenue from that tax base. So maybe Dave can add clarity to that part of the legislation.
You're talking about property taxes in particular?
Property taxes in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, again, a function of state law, state legislature, the Wisconsin Constitution. There's a lot of property in Madison that just can't be taxed. They're just exempt from property taxes. That would include government buildings, so the university, state government, also nonprofit, some nonprofit type of organizations, hospitals, healthcare, certain benevolent organizations, things like that. There's rough estimates that maybe 30% of the overall possible tax base in Madison is exempt from property taxes. Oh. Now, the state does try to provide some offset for that, you know, some aid to offset that for state buildings, the university buildings, but they have a formula for it, and they have only funded 30 cents on the dollar. So there's another area where the state shortchanges Madison in terms of what it should be getting to kind of offset the loss of that tax base and the services that Madison provides, so fire services, some police services, and so on, to those buildings.
Want to put a call out for folks. There's still time to call in and let us know your questions about the upcoming Madison City budget and the big budget shortfall that the city is facing and options for addressing that shortfall. Give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We have folks here in the studio from the Common Council, from the Mayor's Office, from the City Finance Office here to answer your questions about the city budget. You just mentioned services, fire, and police there, and that's one that hasn't come up so far, which is policing, which is obviously comes up a lot in people's perception of city services, but also the cost of city services. And it's no secret, of course, that it's come up in particular since 2020 as a result of increased focus on the role that police play in our society. Is the sort of steady funding for policing in the city necessary? Policing rarely comes up when it's time to talk about cuts. Is that something the city should be considering now? What are your various positions on the topic, and what are you hearing from folks about the funding for policing in the city of Madison?
Well, I think we'll each have a slightly different perspective on this. One thing that is worth discussing in this context is what is called maintenance of effort requirements, which the state legislature recently enacted, which is another way that they constrain our ability to govern our own budget and put some restraints on what one can do with regard to the police and fire budgets in particular, the public safety budgets. And I'll let Dave speak to that. I will say from the mayor, you know, from the mayor's office perspective and at a high level, look, the city of Madison is growing pretty rapidly, you know, certainly for Wisconsin, even in terms of the Midwest or nationally. We've grown higher than our high-end projections would have thought. And when a city is growing, it is rare that the demand for a service goes down. And I think that applies to police as well. The police budget hasn't grown disproportionate to the rest of the budget. It has grown with the rest of the budget. And it has grown in response to the growth of the city and the need for additional services. And, the you know, policing covers a really broad range, right, of things, not by any means just the sort of like, you know, uniform police who arrest folks. It's traffic, it's intervention, violence prevention, et cetera. That said, if we are in a situation where we have to make significant cuts in the city budget, there is unlikely to be any department that is not impacted in some way. And I think, you know, we hope not to be in the situation where we have to make really aggressive cuts as a result of this deficit. But if we do, then police are, that department absolutely will be in the same situation as other departments, with the small caveat of these maintenance of effort requirements. But, you know, it's very difficult. It would be very difficult for us to say that there would be any department that wouldn't be impacted. Mm-hmm. President Figueroa-Cole, yeah. I don't know if you...
To put it into perspective, last year we had an ask of have a 1% cut across the board, and MPD has the largest budget on the city, so they're going to get the largest cut. So to achieve $27 million, we had to have an 8% cut across the city. So that's, again, talking about the numbers, and even like if I were to ignore services at this moment, that it will be a huge impact on MPD and fire. They are like one third of the budget, I think, and you know, roughly one third of the entire budget. So that will definitely impact services. But as Sam says, we have a the city continues to increase to grow, and each agency has grown alone with that need. But if we at the moment of cuts, I think, yeah, there's no one that we can say is safe. And again, the budget is an open book. You can go and look at last year's budget and you can see what, you know, how the 1% transpire. You can also see how that impacts the cost of continuum and how, you know, because that's another number that impacts the final numbers, the final amount that each agency gets. But yeah, I think at this moment so early in the game, everything is on the table. I wouldn't think that, I don't see a solution where we will be able to exclude the biggest agencies on the city. We're talking about $27 million.
So I assume that includes schools and public education as well.
Schools are not in the city budget.
Okay.
So that's a separate budget. The school board, is in charge of that. They have their own property tax authority, and then they get a separate what's called school aid to help finance their activities. But that is not a part of what we're talking about here. That's a separate.
Okay.
In terms of the budget gap, okay, we're talking about. Now, when we talk about property taxes, schools are on the property tax, just like the city, the county, and the tech college.
I guess that's what I'm thinking of, is that bill where you see those divided that way, right?
Right.
Which is another question and another point of clarity. And again, Dave can do a better job than me. But when you look at your tax bill, you see all those different entities there. So a person that pays $10,000 on taxes only gives the city of Madison $3,500 or maybe $34, I don't know. But that's what you actually given. That's the amount that we get to use to provide services, not the entire $10,000 that you're paying on taxes. So that's, I mean, again, anyone, and I, for the past 3 years doing this job, every time that someone confronts me with I pay my taxes, I'm like, yeah, let me look at that. And I tell you, yes, 35% of that is coming to us to give you all the services. And when you really look at that, when you really look at your share of taxes and compare it to garbage pickup every week, recycling every other week, the leaves pickup, the street cleaning, the snow removal, if you were to go and try to gain those services on the private sector, sure. you're not going to have, you did not pay enough taxes to get the privilege of having so many services.
We had listener Ian call back to clarify. He specifically wanted to point to the people who are making lots of money off the growth happening in Madison, such as developers. He wonders if and how the money they are making can trickle down and cover the deficit. So the profits that developers are making from this huge amount of growth in Madison, why is that not translating to public services?
We can only tax the value of the property. We do not have a sales tax or an income tax, which I think would be about, if we're talking about profits made or something like that, that taxation is happening at the state level. And it's not trickling down as we saw because Madison has the lowest amount of state aid per capita in the state. It's trickling to other places. And I think Sam spoke about yeah. the bigger picture around what's happening with tax policy at the state level. And that does have an impact on local level and the amount of revenue available for services.
Yeah. We just, go ahead quickly, Sam.
Well, I was just going to add as well, and Dave did speak about this earlier, but the way that the state allows us to tax property actually limits how much we can tax these new developments, right? So we don't, it's not as if when new, when new buildings come into the city that we can increase our property taxes by that much. There's a formula that the state uses that actually discounts the amount of new construction. So I think that's, I mention it because it's something that folks say too all the time. Oh, I see all these buildings going up, you know, there must be scads of money coming in. Why isn't, you know, why can't we tax that the same way? And the answer is the state limits that to, I forget, you know, around 2% or something was the growth. So even though this, we are building more than 2% more new construction, even though we are, the city is growing by more than that, and the city's costs are growing by more than that, the amount that we can actually increase our revenues by is limited to 2%. So anyway, that wanted to add that bit of clarification to perhaps in partial answer to Ian's question.
Yeah. Well, I am coming away from this conversation with a much more nuanced understanding of the limitations that state politics places on city budgeting. So thank you all for sharing that. I want to make sure we have a moment here before we wrap to advertise, give a shout out for those upcoming opportunities for engagement. Alder Figueroa Cole.
Yes. So we have a few more engagements coming up. The next one is on the west side. We have all the dates on the council page. So if you can, if you go to cityofmadison.com, you can navigate to the department of the city council. And on the first page, you can scroll down and you can have all the dates in there. Or you can go to cityofmadison.com to get the dates.
The next one, I'll just put in a plug. May 16th at Memorial High School on the west side at 6 p.m. We encourage anyone from across the city, you don't have to be from the west side. And I'll just note that there is also a virtual session. I don't remember the date off the top of my head, but it's May 20-something.
It's May 30th.
May 30th.
Yep.
Thanks,
at
Dave.
At the Madison Municipal Building in room 215.
And folks can also, there will be a Zoom link if you go to yep. the websites that Alder Figueroa Cole provided. So you can tune in online to that too for folks who are unable to come in person for one reason or another.
Great. And we are asking people to register, not because you have to, you don't have to register, you can show up, but we'd like for you to register to make sure we have enough water, snacks, whatever we need to have available there for you.
That's thank Madison you. Common Council President Yannette Figueroa Cole. Thanks so much for coming in today, Yannette.
Thank you for having us.
I've also had with me in the studio David Schmidtke, Finance Director for the City of Madison. Thanks for being here, David.
Glad to be here.
And thank you for being here, Sam Munger, Mayor Satya Rhode Conway's Chief of Staff.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for listening to A Public Affair here today on WRT 89.9 FM Madison. I'm Douglas Haynes. I'd also like to thank today's receptionist, Amy Lutzke, engineer Andrew Thomas, producer Jade Isiri Ramos, news director Shali Pittman, and Wart News volunteer Dylan Brogan for help with this show in particular. If you have appreciated the show today, please share it on the Wart Online Archive or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you for listeners for joining us today on A Public Affair here at WRT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned for Madison Book Beat. On today's show, we have... Sorry, I lost my note. There it is. Daniel Colacci on his new collection, The Story of Your Obstinate Survival.
Gaza, put forward by mediators from Egypt and Qatar. But Israeli media are quoting officials as saying the terms are not those that Israel agreed to and include conclusions that it can't accept. A proposal that was being discussed over the weekend involved a temporary truce and the release of some Israeli hostages. Frank Gardner is in Jerusalem.
The only time we've seen large numbers of hostages released out of Gaza have been with a negotiated deal by Qatar and Egypt with the support of the United States. And that appears to be what's going on now, because the message